Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Saturday, February 5th, 2022, Weekender edition. Section A. Big week for oil as prices head above $90. By Mella McEwen. Indications of tight oil supplies, frigid weather in the U.S., and continued geopolitical tensions were a recipe for rising oil prices. And rise they did, climbing past the $90 barrier for the first time since 2014 and posting their seventh consecutive weekly gain. West Texas Intermediate on the New York Mercantile Exchange jumped 6% for the week. Prices rose all five trading days. The posted price closed at $88.79, according to Plains All-American. Frigid temperatures did not give a boost to natural gas prices, which rose three of five trading days, beginning with the week with a 23.5-cent jump. Oil prices could reach $100, said energy economist Carr Ingham, speaking with the Reporter-Telegram. Are they going to stay there for any extended length of time? I think not. Ryan Keyes, president and co-founder of Triple Crown Resources, told the Reporter-Telegram his company is remaining cautious amid rising prices. He listed three reasons his company is holding steady. Hedges. We're not realizing $90 a barrel for our hedges. If this level of pricing hangs in there for 6 to 12 months, then most of our oil will be fetching the higher prices, which so we may reassess in the back half of 2022. Service cost inflation. Costs for almost everything have increased, some substantially, especially in the spot market where we're most busy. So our costs have gone up since last year. And this ties a bit to number two, but the industry is spread very thin. There are shortages for everything, sand, casing, etc. And the experience in the field isn't as good as it was last year since we've gotten so much busier. Lots of new people. So our efficiencies are going to suffer a bit compared to last year. It just takes longer to bring on a new well now than it did last year. Keyes added that he imagined other independents are feeling the same concerns. There are public operators saying they're not seeing reasons two and three, and I'm not sure if I believe that, he wrote. Keyes added, there's such a thing as too much too fast. I hope oil prices sit still a bit and take a breather and allow the industry to catch back up. This kind of volatility is great for next quarter's revenues, but it's not good for the long-term health of the industry or the global economy. If you asked me if I'd prefer $80 a barrel to or $120 a barrel, I'd pick $80. Ingham said price analysts tend to discount the response of both producers and consumers to high prices. There will be a response to these price levels, he said. Why wouldn't you want to bring online more barrels at 90 than 60? Even members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and allied producing nations may be tempted to bring to market more supplies than they currently plan. Ed Longenecker, president of the Texas Independent Producers Association, predicted higher prices will indeed bring about more activity. Private operators will continue to add activity with improving economic conditions, rising global demand, and a favorable commodity price environment, but some U.S.-focused supermajors will also play a role in the growth story this year. We remain bullish and expect to the Permian to account for over 90% of the U.S. production growth in 2022. Those higher prices and additional production will serve to mitigate prices, Ingham said, as consumers cut back consumption because of higher prices, and the increased amount of inventory will help bring prices down. Expectations were that oil prices would be higher in 2021 than in 2020, and that they would be higher for at least part of 2022. Expectations for 2022 are all over the place, but expectations are for prices at least holding on an annual basis, or at least just above 2021 levels. Global oil demand is recovering rapidly and forecast to continue growing, and there's a sense supplies are not keeping up. Response to that depends on where you are on the globe. In the U.S., it points to increased activity and increased production. Current prices are certainly conducive to increasing activity levels and production. Nothing the market is doing suggests to operators anything other than bringing more oil. This is occurring outside politics and outside the desire of many to consume less oil, produce less oil, he said. Check out these great date night locations. Special events will be happening in these places Valentine's weekend in Midland. Dinner. Low Street Books will host a V-Day pre-fix, which includes a four-course dinner for two, plus a bottle of champagne. The dinners will be at 7 p.m. February 11th, 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. February 12th, and 7 p.m. February 14th. The dinner will be crostini roast beef, pesto bucatini with burrata, seared scallop with prosciutto, cilantro and English pea with a phyllo cheesecake for dessert. To reserve, visit www.events.brite.com. Tall City Barbecue and Sear and Social are partnered to host a four-course meal with live music and dancing on Valentine's Day. The event will be from 6 to 10 p.m. at the Horseshoe Education Building on February 14th. Reservations come with one glass of champagne voucher per person. Tickets for couples and tables are available. To reserve, visit tallcitybbq.com. Texas Sun Winery will host a Valentine dinner and wine pairing at 7 p.m. February 14th. Chef Kim from Indulgence Catering will create a five-course dinner with wine pairings. To purchase tickets, visit texassunwinery.vinesos.com. Cafe at the Gardens will have a Valentine's dinner February 14th with two time options available, 5:30 to 7:30 and 8 to 10. Dinner will include crab-stuffed mushrooms, strawberry spinach salad, entree choices of filet mignon, blackened tuna steak, and Madeira chicken. Dessert will be a layered red velvet cake with two chocolate-covered strawberries. Reservations, call 432-687-1478. Ranchland Hills Golf Club will host a special Valentine's couples dinner on February 14th. The four-course meal will feature a mini beef Wellington, blue cheese wedge, choice of entree between filet and prawns, or salmon and prawns, with cream brulee and chocolate-covered strawberries for dessert. Seating times will be at 6 and 8 p.m. Reserve by calling 432-683-2041. Opal's Table will be open from 4:30 to 9:30 on Valentine's Day. Experience the restaurant's winter menu featuring lobster and avocado toast, grilled bone-in pork chop, shrimp and grits, Texas redfish, and more. Reservations at opalstable.com. Garlic Press is now accepting Valentine's Day reservations. Experience a unique menu with a specialty dessert. To reserve, call 570-4020. Venezia Restaurant released a new menu just in time for Valentine's Day. The menu features seafood, pastas, and veal options. Reservations can be made at www.opentable.com. Librado will be open from 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. on Valentine's Day. Indulge in a seafood tower with someone special. To reserve, call 432-218-7260. Beryl and Derek will have dinner specials for Valentine's Day. The specials include espresso-crusted ribeye with a Frangelico compound butter, served with white cheddar whipped potatoes and prosciutto-wrapped asparagus, pan-seared halibut with a pomegranate beurre blanc, served with jasmine citrus rice and roasted carrots, and stuffed chicken with goji berries, apricots, Bursin cheese, topped with a wine reduction, served with herbed quinoa and roasted squash. The restaurant will also feature a dueling dessert of dark chocolate cake with vanilla bean cream, served with raspberry and strawberry macaroons. The specialty cocktails will be by White Buffalo. The night will be accompanied by live music. The dinner offer is available starting 5 p.m. February 12th until February 14th. Reservations must be booked by February 11th. For reservations, call 653-5803. Pie Social says share a pizza with your special someone, whether it's a margarita, peach, or prosciutto, or a Wagyu pie. There are options for everyone. Don't forget to check out their specialty cocktail menu. The restaurant is open 10 to 10 on Valentine's Day. Chinese Dumpling will be open February 14th. Patrons can enjoy a free dessert that day. Texas Fudge is offering a Valentine's Day cheesecake on February 14th. Call 557-4183 to order. Plain cheesecakes are $35 and pink cheesecakes are $35. Cheesecakes with strawberry toppings are $40 and pink cheesecakes with chocolate hearts are $40. Deliveries can be made February 13th and 14th. Galentine's Day, a day when women celebrate their female relationships, is typically celebrated on the day before Valentine's Day. Rooster's Diner is offering a Galentine's Day brunch from noon to 2 on February 12th. The event is $200 for a table of four, which includes four entrees, mimosa setups, and two bottles of champagne. To reserve, call 413-3016. Take selfies and celebrate Galentine's Day from 11 to 1 on February 13th at I Love My Selfie with Bellini Bar. There will be Bellinis, games, prizes, and selfies with gal pals. The event benefits the Safe Place of the Permian Basin. Tickets are available at bookio.com/I Love My Selfie. Extra parking space at the airport boosting revenue for Midland by Stuart Green. There are more parking options at Midland International Airport, and it's paying off for the city of Midland. Extra lots and an extra 800 parking spots are helping boost revenue. In fact, the city reported raising nearly $1.39 million in net parking revenue through the first 3 months of the fiscal year. And even as impressive, there is more room for more, according to Justine Ruff, Director of Airports for the city. Ruff said this week that during the Thanksgiving weekend, traditionally one of the busiest of the year at Midland International, the vehicles weren't overflowing into the neighboring lots, but the parking lots were filled to around 85%. The parking lot expansion was part of an improvement project that included two new lots with lighting, rehabilitation of pavement in existing lots, the restriping of lots, new equipment, a new computer system, and more. Now, as a person drives around the airport, they can see signs showing how much parking is available in each lot. The feedback we're getting is that people like it. The cost of the project was $15 million. That money came from an airport fund, which doesn't include local taxpayer money, but money from revenue collected at the airport, including parking. Some federal CARES money also went toward the project. City officials have said no general fund revenue is spent at the airport, and airport revenue doesn't go to the general fund. The same will be true when $7 million is spent for improvements inside and around the terminal. Ruff reminded readers the terminal opened in 1999, and 1 million users a year can create the need to make updates. She said the project includes rehabbing bathrooms, new carpet, and roof work. The $22.7 million in CARES funding that went to Midland International Airport during the pandemic will help foot the bill. She noted during a council update last week that the airport bathrooms project cannot start until contractors receive all the supplies. She said they have about 85% of them right now, but there's no point in starting if they can't complete the bathrooms rehabs because of the supply chain problem. Check out these great date night locations. Special events will be happening in these places Valentine's weekend in Midland. Dinner. Low Street Books will host a V-Day Pre-Fix, which includes a four-course dinner for two, plus a bottle of champagne. The dinners will be at 7 p.m. February 11th, 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. February 12th, and 7 p.m. February 14th. The dinner will be crostini roast beef, pesto bucatini with burrata, seared scallop with prosciutto, cilantro, and English pea with a phyllo cheesecake for dessert. To reserve, visit www.events.bright.com. Tall City Barbecue and Sear and Social are partners. to host a four-course meal with live music and dancing on Valentine's Day. The event will be from 6 to 10 p.m. at the Horseshoe Education Building on February 14th. Reservations come with one glass of champagne voucher per person. Tickets for couples and tables are available. To reserve, visit tallcitybbq.com. Texas Sun Winery will host a Valentine dinner and wine pairing at 7 p.m. February 14th. Chef Kim from Indulgence Catering will create a five-course dinner with wine pairings. To purchase tickets, visit texassunwinery.vinesos.com. Cafe at the Gardens will have a Valentine's dinner February 14th with two time options available, 5:30 to 7:30 and 8 to 10. Dinner will include crab-stuffed mushrooms, strawberry spinach salad, entree choices of filet mignon, blackened tuna steak, and Madeira chicken. Dessert will be a layered red velvet cake with two chocolate-covered strawberries. Reservations, call 432-687-1478. Ranchland Hills Golf Club will host a special Valentine's couples dinner on February 14th. The four-course meal will feature a mini beef Wellington, blue cheese wedge, choice of entree between filet and prawns, or salmon and prawns, with cream brulee and chocolate-covered strawberries for dessert. Seating times will be at 6 and 8 p.m. Reserve by calling 432-683-2041. Opal's Table will be open from 4:30 to 9:30 on Valentine's Day. Experience the restaurant's winter menu featuring lobster and avocado toast, grilled bone-in pork chop, shrimp and grits, Texas redfish, and more. Reservations at opalstable.com. Garlic Press is now accepting Valentine's Day reservations. Experience a unique menu with a specialty dessert. To reserve, call 570-4020. Venezia Restaurant released a new menu just in time for Valentine's Day. The menu features seafood, pastas, and veal options. Reservations can be made at www.opentable.com. Librado will be open from 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. on Valentine's Day. Indulge in a seafood tower with someone special. To reserve, call 432-218-7260. Beryl and Derek will have dinner specials for Valentine's Day. The specials include espresso-crusted ribeye with a Frangelico compound butter, served with white cheddar whipped potatoes and prosciutto-wrapped asparagus, pan-seared halibut with a pomegranate beurre blanc, served with jasmine citrus rice and roasted carrots, and stuffed chicken with goji berries, apricots, bursin cheese, topped with a wine reduction, served with herbed quinoa and roasted squash. The restaurant will also feature a dueling dessert of dark chocolate cake with vanilla bean cream, served with raspberry and strawberry macaroons. The specialty cocktails will be by White Buffalo. The night will be accompanied by live music. The dinner offer is available starting 5 p.m. February 12th until February 14th. Reservations must be booked by February 11th. For reservations, call 653-5803. Pie Social says share a pizza with your special someone, whether it's a margarita, peach, or prosciutto, or a Wagyu pie. There are options for everyone. Don't forget to check out their specialty cocktail menu. The restaurant is open 10 to 10 on Valentine's Day. Chinese Dumpling will be open February 14th. Patrons can enjoy a free dessert that day. Texas Fudge is offering a Valentine's Day cheesecake on February 14th. Call 557-4183 to order. Plain cheesecakes are $35 and pink cheesecakes are $35. Cheesecakes with strawberry toppings are $40, and pink cheesecakes with chocolate hearts are $40. Deliveries can be made February 13th and 14th. Galentine's Day, a day when women celebrate their female relationships, is typically celebrated on the day before Valentine's Day. Rooster's Diner is offering a Galentine's Day brunch from noon to 2 on February 12th. The event is $200 for a table of four, which includes four entrees, mimosa setups, and two bottles of champagne. To reserve, call 413-3016. Take selfies and celebrate Valentine's Day from 11 to 1 on February 13th at I Love My Selfie with Bellini Bar. There will be Bellini's, games, prizes, and selfies with gal pals. The event benefits the Safe Place of the Permian Basin. Tickets are available at bookio.com/I Love My Selfie. County's metrics continued downward slide. By Stuart Doreen. COVID's impact inside Midland County continued its downward slide this past week. From the positivity rate to total cases to the number of inpatients inside Midland Memorial, the COVID metrics showed that Omicron's grip was lessening. The number of inpatients with COVID fell from 95 to 70 on Friday morning. Total hospital occupancy fell from 222 to 229. The positivity rate at Midland Health testing areas dropped for the fourth straight week. The high mark was January with 52%. Thursday of this week, it was the first time the positivity rate dropped below 30%. The number of tests at Midland Health Center Testing Center totaled 397 through Thursday. The peak for tests was 1,394 the 1st of July, the 1st of January. The total number of new cases involving Midland County residents continued to fall. At the pace it was going, the total number of cases would be less than 900 this week. Keeping power on was best for facilities, Amela McEwen. Despite hundreds of millions of dollars spent on winterization efforts ranging from methanol injection to insulating critical lines and valves, keeping electricity flowing to natural gas facilities proved the most effective. That was the finding Friday of the Texas Oil and Gas Association offered a situation report as Winter Storm Landon chilled Texas another day. Texoga President Todd Staples told the media Friday that keeping the power flowing to facilities let technicians troubleshoot issues and keep natural gas supplies flowing to power generators. Production decreased slightly from Thursday to Friday, but with the improvement of daytime temperatures, that is expected to improve. Roads and access to sites continue to be an issue. The association said pipelines are reporting good pressure and there's plenty of storage even with production declines. Staples stressed that the amount of daily gas production statewide, combined with what is already in storage, is well above anticipated demand levels. Staples said those winterization steps were called best practices by the industry before Winter Storm Uri put the word winterization in Texans' vocabulary. In the last year, he said, more energy companies are calling in additional manpower, response teams, and taking steps such as draining tanks in advance of the severe weather, that so those tanks can hold more liquids on site in case trucks can't access the well site due to bad roads. He told reporters he's confident that necessary enhancements and improvements have been made since last February. Those changes have undergone two tests from cold weather in January and again this week. Texans should be proud of the work the industry, legislators, regulators, and others have done and how they came together with the goal of ensuring the grid is reliable. He pointed out that many oil and gas operators are major electricity consumers. We're right there with the homeowners in wanting reliable electric grid. There may be a need to look at standards needed for maximum reliability, he said, such as firm contracts for supplies, for storage, and for transportation. Staples added that there also may be infrastructure issues uncovered, with some power plants getting the supplies they need because of insufficient infrastructure. Bradley Kirk Wright passed away on January 28th. A celebration of life will be held at Grace Bible Church in Dallas on February 7th at 1 o'clock. Go to gracebiblechurch.org to find it. Charles Gregory Short passed away on February 1st. At Greg's request, there will be no memorial service. In lieu of flowers, donation may be made to the Lewy Body Dementia Association. Delora Rogers passed away on February 2nd. Funeral service will be Saturday, February 5th at 2 p.m. at Ellis Funeral Home. Leotis Henderson passed away on January 29th. Viewing will be Sunday, February 6th from 2 to 5 p.m. at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. A graveside service will be Monday, February 7th at 11 a.m. at Fairview Cemetery. Lucian Rudd passed away on Monday, January 31st. A visitation will be 6 to 8 on Saturday, January 5th at Nally Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home. Services will be Sunday at 2 p.m. at Nally Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home Chapel. Rafael Bustamante passed away on January 28th. Arrangements are under the direction of All Faiths Funeral Home in Austin. Ralph Way passed away on January 27th. A memorial service celebrating Ralph's life will be held at First United Methodist Church on February 5th, preceded by graveside at Rest Haven Cemetery at 9 o'clock. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home. Tommy Jones passed away on January 30th. A memorial service will be held at Cotton Flat Baptist Church on Tuesday, February 8th at 2 p.m. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home and Crematory. Zora Henley passed away on December 29th. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home. Peggy Williams passed away on September 3rd. Celebration of life will be at the branch at Nally Pickle and Welsh at 10 a.m. on Monday, February 7th. A viewing will be held Sunday, February 6th between 5 and 7 p.m. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home. Thurman Raymond Crutchfield passed away on January 23rd. Veteran services are pending.
This is Jane reading for the Saturday Odessa American on February the 5th. Food bank chief sees impact of tax credit expiration. In her job as executive director of the West Texas Food Bank, Libby Campbell has seen the effects of the pandemic and the issues revealed by it. The expanded child tax credit, or CTC, part of the American Rescue Plan, impacted 4 million children and decreased child poverty by 40%, information from Children at Risk said. Before the child tax credit expansion, the organization said one in two children of color were not getting the full credit, compared to 1 in 4 white children. These children were also more likely to need the tax credit for fundamental needs, such as food, information from the Children at Risk stated. The children became eligible through the ARP expansion because of three changes: increasing the amount per child, making the CTC fully refundable, thus removing the income requirements that had previously prevented the poorest children from benefiting from it, and giving parents the option to receive half their total credit in monthly payments of $200 to $300, then getting the remaining half when they would normally receive the credit in the spring. Campbell took part in a conference call on February the 2nd, organized by Children at Risk, with representatives from several nonprofits around the state discussing the effect of the expiration. I think it comes back to several conversation points, as the pandemic really has brought some things to light: affordable health care, access to health care, especially in rural communities, and what that looks like and the cost of it, Campbell said. It's also about inflation and the cost of food at the grocery store, the cost of child care, and whether it's worth it for some people to go back to work for what they're paid. When we talk about inflation, what does that really look like to you? Some people, if you make enough money, inflation doesn't really affect you every day. But one thing that we all talked about was the cost of bacon. Probably 90% of Americans, wherever you live, have eaten bacon or bought bacon at some point. A pack of bacon a year ago was $3. Now, if you go and buy a pack of bacon, it's well over $6 in the store, Campbell said. Especially if you're an hourly employee that's paid even $15 or $18 an hour, or maybe even $20 an hour, paying an extra $100 to $150 a month at the grocery store for a family of four can be devastating to your budget. The child tax credit helped families cover the price increases they were seeing and helped lift people out of poverty, Campbell noted. We were able to help children's food insecurity rate at least balance it out, not to continue rising. And now we've lost that. What is the impact really going to be? We really don't know for sure, won't know for the next 60 to 90 days, but I can tell you, looking at what we did in pounds, you can definitely tell when that tax credit started. That's really when our pounds started to go down in our lines. But now we're going to see an increase again, Campbell said. Although it's only been a month since the CTC expired, inflation is continuing to rise and a snow event arrived Wednesday. This will likely mean increased heating and food bills with children being at home. Usually the cycle, if you do get behind in your bills, you don't just magically come back to work and your first paycheck back, you're back to normal. You're making up for lost ground. I think people were either able to tread water with the tax credit or they were able to hopefully pay down some debt and be able to keep up with the rate of inflation, Campbell said. I think a lot of people are truly looking at what it's going to cost to go to work every day. If you consider the cost of fuel, increased grocery bills, and the cost of daycare, it can make people wonder if it is worth what they're paid to do to go to work. If they're going to be in the hole and in the red at the end of the month, it's probably not worth going back to work, Campbell added. A lot of bad things have come from the pandemic, but one good thing is that people are reevaluating their lives, taking into account work-life balance and family time, she said. There's also the consideration of staying home with children who are sick with COVID, having to hold their spot at daycare, and not getting a paycheck because you can't work. These are all scenarios that we have heard that have happened. So I think people really are thinking through where do we make cuts and how do we get by and live in our crazy chaos and still try to provide a stable environment for our families and our homes, Campbell said. Before the pandemic, the food bank was distributing 6.8 million pounds of food. The first year of the pandemic, they were at 10.8 million. Our fiscal year ends at the end of September, so we just finished our fiscal year. In fact, we're just finishing our first quarter of our year. Last year, we did 12.8 million pounds of food distribution to the 19 counties, so we've more than doubled since this all began. There are lots of stories out there that we hear from our clients. They haven't been able to go to work. Maybe their pay's been cut, but they still have a job because of their health insurance. She said they are hearing from a lot of people right now that they don't have enough money to make ends meet, but they also don't qualify for benefits because they're employed. At the same time, they don't want to leave their jobs because they have health insurance. Some have taken on multiple jobs, she said. We're still doing drive-through distributions at Midland and Odessa locations one day a week. We do change the times around based upon the season and try to help reduce wear and tear on our staff. But we still have over 200 cars at the Midland location once a week. And at the High Point at the Odessa location, we were over 650 cars. We distributed 1.4 million pounds of food that month. The number of cars dropped down to 275 to 300, but it's starting to inch back slowly. Most of those were people who had never needed any kind of assistance before. So over 25% of our clients we see today have never needed any form of assistance, whether that's SNAP, unemployment, or food bank. They're kind of new to the system, but we're back over 350-plus cars a week at the Odessa facility, and I suspect that will continue to go up, Campbell said. I think we're going to continue to see probably a big jump come mid-February, and especially in March. I think due in part that will be to the lack of the child tax credit, especially as the cost of groceries increase. The agencies on the call from El Paso, Austin, and Dallas are also starting to see their numbers rise. She said the root cause is probably the pandemic, but now it's become very layered with all these other issues that have developed. Campbell said she always says that West Texas is a very resilient community that takes care of its own. We want to provide stability to our clients and to our community in times of instability, Campbell added. If people are able to volunteer, they can through the volunteer hub. And if they have resources, Campbell said, please donate to the food bank. She added that there is some fatigue among staff from anxiety and worry about COVID, but they have made it through by supporting and rallying around each other. Campbell noted that people who work at the food bank view it as a calling. This is Jane reading for the Saturday Odessa American. Digital Learning launches podcast. For several years, members of the Ector County ISD's digital learning team had played around with the idea of a podcast. In January, they began broadcasting Level Up Your Learning, always looking for new and different ways to reach teachers for professional development. Podcasts were an avenue to do that. It would be a way for us to share information with people anywhere, anytime, Director of Digital Learning Lauren Tavares said. They had plans to launch the podcast, and then COVID hit. Now we're back to a point where I felt like we could take it on, so we started it in early January, Tavares said. They're aiming to have a podcast every 2 weeks. We're going to release a new one every 2 weeks, so we're now up to 2 episodes, Tavares said. Digital learning specialist Jessica Dominguez said they are trying to keep the podcast to no more than 15 minutes. So it's something that they can just listen to on the drive home or on the way to work, on breaks, during lunch, Dominguez said. Tavares added that educators can listen to the podcast during their conference period or while taking a walk. Tavares said they are learning as they go. Jess has been core to helping edit the podcast. We all sit down and we record. If nothing else, we look official because we've got microphones that we use for the podcasts. But then Jess and Amanda Weber, a digital learning specialist, take it and edit it, put it all together, get it ready to go, then are able to shoot it out to the podcast universe. Dominguez said the first podcast introduced them and their view on instructional technology. Now we're moving on to what we call the 4 C's. Creativity, collaboration, communication, and critical thinking. So our plan is for the next 4 podcasts to cover each one of the 4 C's and see how it can be implemented into a classroom, Dominguez said. Tavares said they are hoping to build teachers' pedagogy and understanding of what digital tools can do in their classroom. And so the focus for the podcast will be all about sharing digital learning tools, ideas, lessons that can be used, benefits to our students. It's just a different way to reach people as opposed to having a session from 4 to 5 in the afternoon and people having to come to a training spot. They can do this anywhere. Tavares said that she's had several people tell her they are always waiting to see what the digital team is going to do next. I took that as a huge compliment because we honestly do look for ways. I give a lot of credit to Uvalde ISD. Their blended learning, personalized learning department. We've kind of become friends with their coordinator through different conferences, social media, Facebook, and Twitter, but they actually did a presentation on their podcast and how they put it together, pulled it off, and the different things that they shared. She added that ECISD went to a conference in the fall, and during the session, they decided to try the podcast. We started planning at that point. I give them a lot of credit. I think that shows the power of having that network of people that you can also learn from, follow, and get ideas. I think it's just another learning modality to reach different learning styles, Dominguez said. Tavares said the digital learning team sees a lot of value and puts a lot of focus on personalizing the professional learning for staff. We've already started doing several things and created and built new opportunities with that personalized focus to be able to reach different learning styles for staff and accommodate crazy schedules. Teachers have a million things they're asked to do in a day. And so if we can provide another opportunity that doesn't require them to be sitting somewhere to do it, but still becoming a better educator, I think it's an awesome opportunity, Tavares said. This is Jane reading for the Odessa American for Saturday, February the 5th. O'Rourke talks Texas power grid in Odessa. Texas gubernatorial candidate Beto O'Rourke, Democrat of El Paso, on a Friday stop in Odessa, spoke to more than 75 people during the second stop of his Keeping the Lights On statewide tour. For more than 20 minutes, O'Rourke spoke about his plan for the power grid of Texas. The presentation took place at the Woodson Community Center as O'Rourke laid out a 5-point plan about infrastructure that included winterize the grid, connect Texas to the national grid, help the ratepayer out, stop price gouging, and have an independent market monitor for gas. If we are going to fix it, we have to take it seriously, O'Rourke said during the meeting. O'Rourke stated Friday with plans to spend the next 12 days traveling more than 2,100 miles statewide to speak about the power grid in Texas. There were three elected officials present during O'Rourke's visit, which included Odessa Mayor Javier Hoven, Ector County Commissioner Armando Rodriguez, and Andrews County District Attorney Sean Galloway. After his presentation, O'Rourke spent about 20 minutes fielding questions from the audience. Those questions ranged from stories about last year's power outages to what are his other proposed agenda items in his run for governor. This is Jane reading from the Odessa American for Saturday, February the 5th. Family suing Railroad Commission over dump north of Midland. An East Texas holding company's proposed 9-story tall oil field waste repository 20 miles north of Midland has prompted a lawsuit filed by nearby property owners that is scheduled to be heard in a Travis County court. Claiming that the repository, dug 30 feet into the ground just above the south end of massive Ogallala Aquifer, would probably end up polluting the water. Styled Kelton et al. Versus the Texas Railroad Commission, the suit has been combined with one filed by Mabee Ranch Loyalty Partnership President John W. Mabee, who lives just west of the project that's planned by the High Roller Group of Center in Far East Texas near Louisiana. The case is on the docket of 53rd Civil District Court Judge Maria Cantu Hexel in Austin. A lawsuit spokesperson says $100,000 was given to Texas Railroad Commission Chairman Wayne Christian just after the commission voted 2-1 to approve the project on December 8, 2020. The campaign contributions from HR Environmental of Center, Texas, was recorded on December 11, 2020 by the Texas Ethics Committee in Austin. Christian is a native of Center, whose company, Wayne Christian Financial Services, is there. Speaking on behalf of his family, Midland Oil and Gas attorney Robert W. Bill Kelton III said he was not accusing Christian of taking a bribe. It's legal to give campaign contributions, but it sure does cast a shadow on the integrity of the process when you do it like that, Kelton said. Filed by Austin attorneys Karan Walker and Olga Kobzar, the suit claims High Roller didn't follow the correct legal procedures before asking the TRC for a ruling, specifically that not all the nearby property owners were notified. Efforts to reach High Roller CEO Dustin Bailey were unsuccessful. My cousin Eddie Frank Kelton called me from Greenville to say he had gotten a box of stuff from this company in Center and he wanted to know what it was about, Kelton said. I called the Railroad Commission and they said they were conducting a hearing on the project right then. I immediately faxed them a letter to protest in the fall of 2019 and they recessed the hearing. The case is likely to wind up in the Third Court of Appeals in Travis County, and it may even be presented to the Texas Supreme Court. Kelton said in a TRC trial examiner had recommended against the plan, citing environmental concerns, but the examiner was overridden by Christian and Ryan Sitton, who was succeeded a month later by Jim Wright. Commissioner Christy Craddock voted no. Efforts on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday to get comments from Christian and Craddock were unsuccessful. with maybe Eddie Frank Kelton and Robert Gray having been the only property owners who were notified. Bill Kelton said the other owners now represented by the lawsuit are his father, Robert Williams Kelton Jr. of Atlanta, Texas, his cousins, the estate of the late Claude Denton, Midland attorney Jeff Johnston, and Midland accountant Martin Miller. Kelton said if the project is finally approved, High Roller will almost certainly flip it and sell it to an operator. He said the project is engineered for a location where there is no groundwater, but High Roller wants it erected at a convenient place for oil field trucks hauling waste like sludge from drilling pits. The repository would be built just west of the Well Water Solutions Permian Martin No. 2 saltwater disposal well at 3201 State Highway 349, so called because it is in Martin County. This is Jane reading from the Odessa American for Saturday, February the 5th, in death notices. Gayla Sanders, 56, of Odessa, died on Friday, January 7th, and James Sanders, 62, also of Odessa, died on Thursday, January 20th. Memorial service will be held at 1 p.m. on February the 5th at Mission Dorado Baptist Church. Pastor Jonathan Coleman is officiating. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home of Odessa. June Ragsdale, 83, of Odessa, died on Sunday, January 30th. Services are pending with Frank W. Wilson Funeral Directors of Odessa. Reverend Lucian Rudd, 92, of Midland, passed away on Monday, January 31st. A visitation was held on Saturday at Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Services were held on Sunday at Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Sylvia Clark, age 97, of Odessa, died peacefully on January 25th, surrounded by family which she so dearly loved. She was preceded in death by her beloved husband, Hollis, 23 years ago, and continued to marshal through her as her seven children continued to grow the family tree.
Hello, friends. This is Julie reading from the Odessa American, Sunday, February 6, 2022. Bid set to go out on Youth Center. 25 million facility will be upgraded from current building, by Kim Smith. Ector County is expected to go out to bid soon on its new 25 million youth center, and juvenile probation director Kevin Mann and his staff are thrilled about the opportunities the new facility will afford troubled youth. With the existing detention center was built on East Yukon Road in 1974, it was built with runaways and curfew scaffolds in mind, not the children of today, who are often dealing with mental health and substance abuse issues and accused of serious crimes, Mann said. The new facility on U.S. 385 will not only address practical issues that arise every day in the current building, but it will give staff and stakeholders a better chance at rehabilitating the kids, too, Mann said. Over the last 5 years, an average of roughly 260 kids per year have spent time in the youth center waiting for their cases to be resolved. County statistics show, from 2017 to 2020, another 35 kids per year spent time in the center as part of their sentence or having violated their probation. Court statistics show the kids usually spent anywhere from 3 weeks up to 4 months in the 48-bed facility. Because of the way the facility is laid out and its size, staff often run into problems keeping kids separated from each other, Mann and his staff said. Ideally, the kids should be separated not only in terms of gender, but by what type of crime they are accused of committing by their age. Kids accused of sex crimes or violent crimes should be kept away from other kids, and children with mental health issues should also be held in different areas, they said. Although the kids have separate cells, they are located along two hallways, each of which are attached to a day room. Also attached to the day rooms are classrooms where teachers from the Ector County Independent School District hold classes. As a result, kids who ought to be kept separate often end up encountering each other. The layout also creates security and privacy issues at the current facility, they said. Their maximum security cells are located next to an exit and a day room. Children being booked into the facility can be seen by visiting parents and other kids. In addition, the probation officer's offices and courtroom are within feet of the detention center. We've had kids in those rooms banging and screaming while court's going on, and you have parents up in front with attorneys, facilitator administrator Albert Aguilar said. Kevin can hear those kids all the way to his office, so just imagine the chaos that arises. Those same kids often make it difficult for church services and counseling sessions to be held for a community stakeholder, like Reverend Don Weeks of Connection Christian Church, to schedule a special activity or event, Mann said. In terms of aesthetics, the facility looks like a jail with low ceilings, institutional colors, and little natural light, Aguilar said. The kids have a large gymnasium, but they only have occasional access to a small, secure outdoor courtyard. The new facility's design will address all of these issues, but more importantly, it will also give a department the ability to provide rehabilitative programs to the kids, Mann said. The new facility will increase to 64 beds, have a multi-purpose room, gymnasium, and a vocal building. It will also double the number of day rooms, have a library, and multiple courtyards with space for a garden. The multi-purpose room will allow community stakeholders to come into the facility and expose the kids to all sorts of things they've never seen before, so they know there's more to life than running around on the streets, Mann said. Mann remembers years ago taking a probationer to a doctor and stopping at the restaurant on the way back. The teenager had never seen a menu before and had no idea how to order a meal. He wants to be able to teach kids in detention and on probation basic life skills, and the multi-purpose room will allow them to do that. Every kid thinks, oh, when I get out, I'm going to go buy a house. I'm going to go buy a car. And they don't understand that the financial part of it, Mann said. There are a lot of opportunities. It's just getting there. It's been a long road, but we're getting closer. So hopefully the building will start soon, and we'll go from there. Maria Sosa, assistant probation director, said she knows there are people in the community just waiting for the day they can help out at the new facility. We've had people come up here and offer their time, but the second they see the back, they're like, whenever you get in your new building, call us back and we're more than happy to help you guys, she said. Some people just don't feel safe back there because of the way we have the layout. Sosa is just as excited about the vocational building as she is multi-purpose room. We love the idea of being able to focus and try to help with services. You know, whether it's plumbing or woodwork or whatever's out there. We like the idea of being able to offer those services to our kids, Sosa said. School is not a strong suit for some of our juveniles. So we want to be able to show them a trade. And, you know, hopefully they can practice the trade whenever they move into their adult lives. These buildings could also be used for both the kids who are in the detention facility and those who are on probation out in the community, Sosa said. The county will also be able to once again house kids who are currently being shipped outside the county to serve their time, Mann said. In October 2020, the kids began sending kids who were adjudicated delinquent or violators of their probation to other counties to serve their time. Right now, it costs the county $197 per inmate per day to send those kids out of the county, he said. Once the new facility is open, those kids will be able to stay in Ector County, and their families will be able to visit them more readily, Sosa said. In addition, the county will also be able to bring back an aftercare program for those kids to help them transition back into the community. Mann said the county may also be able to offer open bed to other communities who are also having to ship their kids hundreds of miles away. The whole purpose of a juvenile criminal justice system is to rehabilitate, not punish, Mann said. It's keeping them in the shallow end. We say that all the time. You can't put a kid in a room and lock them up and think kids are going to get any better, Mann said. The kids that are detained here We keep them out of their room, and we try to provide as much programming as we can. If you put them in there and ignore them, you're not doing anything. You're just keeping them off the street. But when they get out of here, I mean, they have, what have they learned? They're going to go back to those same behaviors. Mann, whose department considers out of 8 probation officers and 17 supervision officers, said they work extraordinarily hard to help the county's kids avoid the adult criminal justice system. Over the last 5 years, the county has allowed roughly 120 kids a year avoid being entered into the system through a detention prosecution program, statistics show. If first-time offenders and kids accused of minor crimes perform certain tasks and don't reoffer within a specific time period, the charges against them are dropped. Court stats show that over the last 5 years, the probation department supervisors are an average of 51 kids on regulation probation. In an average year, 8 kids are on a more stringent form of probation. The probation department cares about whole families, not just children, though, Mann said. It's just not this umbrella approach. Oh, well, we're just going to work on the kids. You have to involve the family in everything we do. We're not only working with a kid, but we'll take the parent for a job interview, or we'll take them to counseling, or we'll provide stuff they need in the home. It's not all unusual for his officers to help out with shoes and blankets or refer families to social services, he said. It's not only, hey, follow these rules. It's, hey, we want to give you all the skills to help your family out so you'll be better citizens. Because these kids aren't going anywhere, Mann said. They're not moving off. These families have their roots here, and they're going to stay in this community. And do we want to work with them now? Or as juveniles, or let the adult system deal with them later.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.